Good afternoon. My name is Bonnie, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to EPA's Quarterly Environmental Justice Conference Call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Garcia, you may begin your conference.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. Welcome again to the Environmental Justice Community Outreach Call that we are trying to hold once every 3 months and trying to hold firm to that. As in past phone calls, what I'll do is we're going to go through a few updates and try to respond to some of the comments we received through our website and through emails. And then we're going to open it up for a general Q&A. So first, I would just like to update everybody on Plan EJ-2014. This is the plan that we issued for public comment July of 2010, and it's still in draft. We received about 117 comments, and we're reviewing the comments. And the different programs are, I guess, taking ownership of the many different work groups that we have. And we have lead staff working on these. And what the plan is to finalize implementation plans for public review. And so we're going to come out with those hopefully in the next 3 weeks. It's a little bit later than we had hoped. We hoped we would get it out the beginning of February. It looks more like early March. But we look forward to, once again, having the public review those and see where we are going with Plan EJ-2014. And so I won't go through a whole discussion of what the implementation plans will have, but generally for each area of focus, and for each tool that we highlighted in Plan EJ-2014, the implementation plan will talk about the deadlines and the work plan moving forward for EPA. So we look forward to getting that out, and you'll probably be getting it through emails and posted on the web. The next item I just want to quickly update folks on since our last call is on the Environmental Justice Interagency Work Group. As many of you know, the administrator, along with Chair Nancy Sutley, Chair of the Council for Environmental Quality, Nancy Sutley, reinvigorated the interagency work group at the highest level. And on September 22nd last year, we had a cabinet-level meeting. Coming out of that meeting, one of the first outcomes or deliverables was to hold a forum for the public. That was held on December 15th, and even though it was by invitation only, we had overextended our RSVPs, and a lot of people came in from all over the country, and we got many good comments and recommendations to the different agencies. There were about 15 agencies represented at the White House Forum, and, of course, the exciting part was that the cabinet-level members joined us for each of the different sessions, and we're there to participate with the community groups that were represented and other stakeholders from the states and other federal agencies. And the going forward, the interagency work group has committed to doing more community-based or local, regional outreach. And a few of the agencies were represented in Alaska at the Alaska Environment Forum, and that was an all-day event with the different agencies and stakeholders who were able to make it to Alaska, to Anchorage in Alaska. A lot of the native villages and some of the tribal representatives were there, and it was truly educational and informative, and we definitely came back with a lot of good recommendations, and we think it was overall a day of really good dialogue between the agencies and the different stakeholders. So those are my two quick updates. We're going to have an update on three other, I think, very interesting, I guess, initiatives and work that is going on here at EPA. And I'm going to turn it over to Carlos to introduce the topics.
Thanks, Lisa. My name is Carlos Evans. I work for Lisa Garcia. And as you know, if you're on this call, we're trying to make this call relevant to the issues that you see in your communities. So we, before each call, we ask you for agenda requests or agenda topics that you might want to talk about. And one of those topics is radon. So we have on the call the Office of Air and Radiation to talk about the Federal Radon Summit. Is OAR on the call? Maybe not. Okay. So we'll wait for them. Another topic that people wanted to talk about was enforcement, civil and criminal enforcement. So we have Melissa Marshall on the call from OECA, the Office of Enforcement Compliance Assurance. Melissa, are you on the call?
I am, Carlos. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, I understand that there's interest in knowing about the EJ and the enforcement process. When we enforce our environmental laws, we consider EJ in, throughout the process. And there are basically sort of five stages to the process of enforcing the environmental laws. You have strategic planning where, you know, basically where should EPA take enforcement action and why. Then you have targeting either specific areas or specific facilities. The next step is inspecting for violations, which we may or may not find. When we do, developing cases and then bringing the case to conclusion, which almost all the time is through settlements, but we do occasionally have to litigate the matter. It's not really a stage, but sort of as a sixth part of this is that we're really trying to emphasize communicating the EJ results of our actions now, too. Basically, when we do strategic planning as to where we should go, why, we consider various things. First is we look at what we call initiatives, and these are areas in which we see nationwide there are major environmental and enforcement issues that need to be dealt with. And right now we have a number of them that I'll just mention. The first is keeping raw sewage and stormwater runoff out of our waters, which is a particular problem in some of the inner city, urban, older areas of this country where we have sewer overflows and related issues. The next is cutting animal waste in order to protect surface and groundwaters, and that's largely focused on what we call concentrated animal feeding operations. It's basically like industrialized farms where you have, you may have many hundreds or thousands of animals confined in one area, and they create a massive amount of waste, which is frequently somewhat uncontrolled. Next is reducing widespread air pollution from the largest sources, especially coal fire utilities, cement facilities, glass, acid sectors. I think you may have seen been a lot of press over it in the last couple of years about the air pollution, especially from the coal-fired utilities that generate electricity. They contribute significantly to some of the, the pollutants that come from them are highly tied to respiratory issues, you know, asthma rates and that sort of thing. And next is cutting air toxic pollution that affects communities' health. And air toxics are pretty much what they say they are. They're the energy extraction sector is another one. And finally, reducing pollution from mineral processing operations. And those are, I know a good number of those are located right in EJ areas. We have those initiatives. We also make special efforts in other areas. For instance, we have underway a clean water action plan in which we're enhancing various aspects of, and this is an agency-wide effort, various aspects of the Clean Water Act, and enforcement is right in there in terms of how can we be more effective and aggressive in dealing with the pollution from those. I don't know if you all are familiar with the term showcase communities, but both the Clean Water Action Plan and showcase communities are where we look at areas in which, maybe watersheds or dense areas where there are a lot of sources of pollution, and we look for what are the enforcement areas with enforcement problems within those areas. And many of them are, the showcase communities are where we're working with communities to provide grants and help them with their environmental situation. And we're looking at those as opportunities to do enforcement as one aspect. Other opportunities are out there. We do something called what we refer to as core enforcement, and that's basically, you know, the day-to-day enforcement we do that doesn't have a high special emphasis. It is it's the routine. You know, some of it is statutorily required. Other is just, you know, your baseline enforcement. That's still another opportunity in which to look for where we can make changes with respect to EJ concerns. We also, in terms of looking for opportunities, we coordinate with states and tribes. When we target which facilities that we're going after, you know, one aspect that we look at is where are they located? What is the community like that they're affecting? When we go to a facility or an area and, you know, do inspections, we pay attention to what the characteristics of the area. You know, we document it and communicate our observations. When we develop cases where there are violations, as part of the case development, we also look at, we make sure that we've looked at what is the affected community. Here we may use, not only who's just at the gate, the fence line, but also what is the larger community that is surrounding these facilities and how are they affected by the pollution from this. And in settlement, we look for opportunities in the settlement process to enhance the environmental or health area of the surrounding communities. Just by way of example, last year we had a settlement with Kansas City in Missouri with respect to their sewer overflows. And as part of the settlement, we were able to phase in improvements to the sewer systems to prevent the overflows, and we did it in areas that were very low income and I believe highly minority too. And not only did we want to phase it into those areas, but there were also high numbers of overflows in them, so it made sense on a couple of fronts. In those areas, we were also successful in getting the city to agree to have put in green infrastructure. By this, we mean rain gardens and permeable pavement, green roofs, and other ways to control rain and, when you get high amounts in bad storms or whatever, not only did that control the amount of water that would go into these sewer systems and flood out of them again, but it also created green space for these communities. And we thought that was very significant. But that's the civil side of things. There's a whole second part of enforcement, which is the criminal aspect. John?
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is John Jacobs, and I'm an attorney in EPA's Office of Criminal Enforcement Forensics and Training. And with me is Becky Barnes, our assistant director as well. And we're going to give you a brief overview of EPA's criminal enforcement program, which many people, even within EPA, really don't know much about. And we'd like to tell you how we're briefly integrating environmental justice considerations into our enforcement program, and if we have time to highlight two recent investigations and prosecutions that were resolved successfully that had EJ-related considerations. So Becky and I are going to pinch hit depending on what portion of the presentation we're in, so please bear with us. But EPA's criminal enforcement program was actually established back in 1982, and the Office of Criminal Enforcement Forensics and Training has approximately 400 employees across the United States in several divisions, which Becky will describe in a minute. But we focus on cases that we consider having the most egregious environmental violations and ones where the violations are what we call knowing, negligent, or willful. And these types of violations are typically ones where there are a history of repeated violations by the facility or the individual. There's deliberate misconduct resulting in the violation. There's concealment of misconduct or falsification of records, tampering with monitoring equipment, or operating without a permit, license, manifest, or other required documentation under the federal statutes. And our office coordinates with other offices within OECA, including the Office of Civil Enforcement and the Office of Compliance. We work very closely with our media program offices. We coordinate, of course, with our U.S. Attorney's offices in the Department of Justice's Environmental Crime Section, who prosecute our cases, and we refer our investigations to them, as well as with our state and federal counterparts through what we call Environmental Crimes Task Forces. And right now I'm going to turn the presentation over to Becky to describe OSEF's composition.
Good afternoon, folks. I'll just repeat that EPA's criminal enforcement program exists to investigate and bring to justice the most serious environmental crimes committed by individuals and corporate defendants. And of the defendants, about 80% of those defendants convicted are individuals, and about 20% are corporations. Because we enjoy strong support by the United States Attorney's offices in prosecuting our cases, we have about a 90% conviction rate. Now, within OSEF, and particularly in the Office of the Criminal Investigation Division, we have about 200 agents, a little more than 200 agents right now. The special agents in EPA are fully authorized law enforcement officers, and they're located in about 40 locations across the country. And we use the traditional law enforcement techniques. That is, we execute warrants, we make arrests, we use forensic techniques. We have including computer retrieval and evaluation. And basically, what we try to do as a partner and as a member of the of OECA is that we strive to make a difference where people live and work.
Wait, 2 minutes. Okay. If I talk quick, please bear with me. We have generally criminal enforcement authority in most of EPA's environmental statutes, and most of the penalties are what we call felonies, where there's imprisonment for more than 1 year. And the bulk of our investigations involve the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, but we do have investigations in nearly every other statute to which EPA is authorized. We also investigate related violations under Title 18 of the U.S. Code, ranging from false statements to mail fraud to smuggling. Why does our program build criminal cases? And we have several factors why. And among the largest are we want individuals and corporations to have accountability for criminal conduct. We want to deter future conduct. We want to ensure that noncompliance is simply not a cost of doing business that you can pay with a fine. And we want to ensure program integrity given EPA's increasing self-reliance, increasing reliance on self-reporting. So where do we get our cases from? Where do we get our leads from? And most of them come from concerned citizens like you who are listening to this call, and you can either call EPA or send us a tip through the Internet. Other sources of information are former employees or current employees of businesses and companies. And then we work with our EPA partners here, our state and local counterparts, to also get information. And we like getting information as quickly as possible because time is really of the essence in terms of having a successful investigation. We have a 5-year statute of limitation. Many of our investigations do take 4 to 5 years. Evidence can get lost over time. Witnesses forget, as we all do. And witnesses, unfortunately, disappear at times. So I think right now we'll quickly transition to highlight two recent prosecutions that we recently did. And do you want to start with yours, Becky?
Yeah, I'll be very quick. The first case, let me just say that committing any crime against the environment is wrong. And when that crime jeopardizes human health, it's inexcusable. And when that crime is committed by a government official charged to protect the citizens, it's reprehensible. Donald Patterson was employed by the city of Detroit as a lead paint inspector. His job was to ensure that all paint-based lead hazards were safely removed from the homes that he inspected. Instead, Mr. Patterson used his position to obtain cash from the owners and renters of homes in exchange for false certification of the homes that they were free of lead and for providing fraudulent lead removal training. Mr. Patterson pled guilty. He admitted that he accepted cash in connection with fraudulent abatement of lead hazards to which children were being exposed at 4 separate locations. He was sentenced on February 8, 2011, to 3 years and 10 months in prison and an additional 24 months of supervised release. And this case is investigated by the EPA investigators in coordination and cooperation with the FBI. So that's one example. Okay. I think we probably...
Do we have time for another? Or?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay.
Just quickly.
The second case we wanted to highlight is called U.S. v. Southern Union Company. And there, in December, the First Circuit Court of Appeals in Boston upheld a 2008 conviction for illegally storing mercury at its facility in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, and also upheld an $18 million fine. And this involved mercury, which is, as many of us know, an extremely toxic substance, even in very small quantities. And back in 2001, Southern Union employees began a program where they removed what they call gas regulators from customers' homes, brought them to their facility by the Seekonk River, and stored many of the regulators there and also began removing mercury from many of these regulators. And by 2004, there was over 140 pounds of mercury stored on the site. The mercury was often stored in unsecured containers, glass jars, plastic jugs in a facility where there was very little security. The fence surrounding the facility had gaps in it. Many of the buildings were vandalized and in poor condition, and most of all, there were no hazard warning signs posted that mercury was stored in these buildings. In July 2004, youth broke into the building, took many containers of mercury, spilling it throughout the facility as well as nearby apartment buildings. The theft was not known for several weeks, but once it was detected, the apartment complex was evacuated. Residents were forced to live elsewhere for several months. Many were exposed to mercury and had elevated mercury levels, and the cleanup ultimately cost around $6 million. We investigated and referred the matter to the Department of Justice. It was prosecuted. A jury convicted Southern Union, and at sentencing, the judge imposed a $6 million fine on the company, which was essentially equal to the cost of the cleanup. But he also imposed $12 million in community service payments. Hundreds of thousands of dollars went to the children's hospital to treat children exposed to hazardous chemicals. Other hundreds of thousands of dollars went to the Red Cross and emergency management entities. But $11 million was sent to is to be managed by a foundation where, among other things, they will engage in environmental education, environmental remediation, conservation, and children's health exposure to hazardous waste and toxins. And this case was important to EPA because it involved a community that our Environmental Justice Strategic Enforcement Assessment Tool gave a score of 2, so it was in the top 20% of EJC scoring. And this area, this community is nearly 31% minority, very low income, and nearly 11% of the population live below the poverty line. And we believe that Southern Union's conduct posed a significant risk to the community, particularly because this facility was located in a densely populated neighborhood. Tenements and apartment buildings were adjacent to the facility. Several schools, including an elementary school, were within a block, so kids were walking right by this facility and potentially exposed to mercury. Homeless people slept on the property, and emergency workers were never told that hazardous waste was being stored at the facility. So we're very pleased with the outcome of this trial and the appeal, and we have other cases that we can tell you about in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John. Thanks, Melissa, John, and Becky, for a great overview of the program and examples of actual cases that benefit communities.
I just want to quickly say one of the most important things that was mentioned in that is that the EPA gets information and I guess tips to use a simple term from communities and even sometimes from workers. So I think it's just important for everybody on the call to remember that it's important also to hear from the community and to get tips to help sometimes bring this to the level of EPA and to get EPA involved. So thank you.